From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, two scientists, one an atheist, the other an atheist turned born-again Christian. Richard Dawkins is an evolutionary biologist. In his bestseller, The God Delusion, which recently came out in paperback, he writes about why he's an atheist and why he thinks science is incompatible with a belief in God. Francis Collins headed the Human Genome Project. He finds God's plan in the genetic code. In his book, The Language of God, Collins explains why he believes in God and why his scientific research deepens his faith rather than challenges it. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Paranoid Park, the new film by Gus Van Sant, about a slacker skateboarder. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Can you be a scientist and believe in God? Are science and religion compatible? We're going to get two very different responses to that question from two scientists. On the second half of our show, I'll speak with Francis Collins, who headed the Human Genome Project, which mapped the genetic code of human beings. He's an evangelical Christian and believes that in studying DNA, he is finding God's code. But first we'll hear from Richard Dawkins, a British evolutionary biologist and the author of the controversial bestseller The God Delusion, which has just come out in paperback. He's an atheist and proud of it. He says the God hypothesis, that there is a supernatural intelligence who deliberately designed the universe and everything in it, is a scientific hypothesis that should be analyzed as skeptically as any other. Dawkins is a professor of the public understanding of science at Oxford University. Do you feel particularly strongly about atheism because your branch of science, evolution, has come under attack by certain Christian fundamentalists who think evolution violates their religion?
Yes. My subject of biology is quite difficult for people to teach in America now at the school level. I think it's not so bad at university, because at university, I mean, most universities take evolution seriously and seem not to be under the control of local school boards. However, there are constant rumors and more than rumors of teachers all throughout the United States being intimidated by parents, by local school boards, by even by the children they're trying to teach, and prevented by intimidation from teaching their own subject, from teaching their science, the science of evolution. And that obviously is very disquieting to any biologist, and I'm no exception.
No, of course, not all religion and not even all Christian fundamentalists disapprove of evolution or teaching evolution.
It's very important to say that, and I'm glad you raised that, because it's one of the unfairnesses that religious people who are sensible, relatively sensible religious people, who of course accept evolution just as much as I do, and get very annoyed at being tarred with the same brush as the fundamentalists, many of whom actually literally believe the world is only 6,000 years old, and which is, it should be a joke, but for the fact that some 50% of the American population believe it. But it is important, as you say, and as I often say, to stress that not all Christians are of that dotty opinion.
Now, compare that opinion with yours, where those two figures come from.
Oh, do you mean the true age of the
exactly.
the universe?
Yes.
The currently established age of the Earth is 4.6 billion years. If you compare that with 6,000 years, it's equivalent to believing that the distance from, say, Philadelphia to San Francisco is about 7 yards.
And the 6,000 years comes from?
It comes from the Bible. It comes from looking up all those begats, so-and-so begat so-and-so, who begat so-and-so, and their ages are given, add the ages up together, and you come up with a date of 4004 BC for the origin of the world, indeed of the universe.
Do you think that religion and evolutionary biology ask a lot of the same questions but come up with different answers?
Well, I do think that, and not all my scientific colleagues do. There is a movement among scientists to say that religion and science are about totally different things, and they sort of don't impinge on one another, and they're both equally true in their own sphere. I don't hold to that view. I think they're about the same thing, in the sense that they both aspire to explain the universe. They both aspire to explain why we're here, what's the meaning of life, what's it all about, what's the role of humanity, and so on. I think that all those questions are susceptible of a scientific explanation. Traditionally, religion has always given the explanation for the answer to those questions, wrongly. And so my attitude is rather different from that voguish scientific attitude that there's no overlap. I think there's plenty of overlap. It's just that religion gets it wrong.
What do you mean by that? That religion gets it wrong?
Well, obviously in the case of evolution, but as we've seen, that doesn't apply to all Christians. My point when I try to say that religion and science are about the same thing is that a universe with a God would be, scientifically speaking, a very different kind of universe from a universe without a God. It is a scientific question whether there is a gigantic intelligence somewhere at the root of the universe. Either there is or there isn't. It's not a sort of poetic matter. It's a scientific matter. Either there is or there isn't a God. It may be very difficult to decide the question, and I make an effort to look at the probability. I'm quite convinced you can't disprove the existence of God, but I think you can put a probability value on it, and I think the probability is very low.
You know, some people see God as a more mystical, like unknowable, invisible, unnameable presence that somehow holds the universe together and gives it meaning and expression and beauty and everything else that it has, but would be invisible to the tools that science has to investigate the world.
Let me make a distinction between two versions of what you've just said. There's what I would call the Einsteinian version, which pays homage to the mysteries that lie in the universe at the base of physics, the mysteries that physics has yet to solve and may never solve. Einstein had immense reverence for that, as do I. Einstein used the word God for the deep problems, for those fundamentals which we don't understand and may never understand. But I would want to make a distinction between that Einsteinian view and the one that says there is a spirit which has some sort of intelligence. There is a supernatural, intelligent, creative being who created the universe and made up its laws. I think that's radically distinct from the Einsteinian view that the laws of physics are renamed God. And I have no quarrel with somebody who wants to use the word God for the fundamental laws of the universe. My only quarrel would be that it's confusing to everybody else. But once we've set confusion on one side, then I have no quarrel with that. What I do have a quarrel with is people who confuse that with God in the sense of some kind of supernatural intelligence or creator who worked it out. And I think there really is a big distinction there.
Well, since you brought up Einstein, and since you quote Einstein several times in your book, The God Delusion, let me ask you to read a few of the things that you quote by Einstein about religion.
Right, well, from page 15 of The God Delusion. "It was, of course, a lie what you read about my religious convictions, a lie which is being systematically repeated. I do not believe in a personal God, and I have never denied this, but have expressed it clearly. If something is in me which can be called religious, then it is the unbounded admiration for the structure of the world, so far as our science can reveal it." And further down the same page, I've quoted Einstein as saying, "I'm a deeply religious non-believer. This is a somewhat new kind of religion."
So do you consider yourself religious in the Einsteinian sense?
Yes, I do consider myself religious in the Einsteinian sense. I obviously, with great humility, Einstein was the greatest scientist of the 20th century, maybe ever. And so I humbly am happy to be classed as in his camp in this respect.
Now, you're saying before that you think religion and evolutionary biology ask a lot of the same questions, but come up with different answers and approach the whole thing, of course, differently. You think that all life forms on the planet can be traced to a single ancestor, and that was the subject of a previous book called The Ancestor's Tale. Would you just give us, like, this is asking a lot, but a brief kind of layman's explanation of tracing all living organisms to one creature or organism?
Right. The evidence that all living organisms that have ever been looked at are descended from a single ancestor is mainly biochemical. It's mainly biochemical genetics and the genetic code. The genetic code by which DNA is translated into protein, you could call it the machine code of life, is universal. With very, very tiny differences, every single creature that's ever been looked at, mammals, birds, spiders, insects, worms, oak trees, amoebas, bacteria, they all have the same machine code. They all have the same code that translates from DNA into protein. Now, that, I think, conclusively demonstrates that they have a common ancestor, that which was probably something not really a bacterium, but a bacterium might be the nearest approach to it still alive today. It probably lived some 4 billion years ago. That's not to say that life has not originated more than once, but if there have been other origins of life, they have left no descendants. All surviving life forms are descended from a single common ancestor. That is as certain a fact as any in biology.
Now, I want to quote something that you wrote in The Ancestor's Tale, a previous book about evolution. You wrote, "My objection to supernatural beliefs," and by that you mean religion, "is precisely that they miserably fail to do justice to the sublime grandeur of the real world. They represent a narrowing down from reality, an impoverishment of what the real world has to offer." In what way do you see religion as an impoverishment over what the real world has to offer?
First of all, I think I should say that The Ancestor Tale is an extremely long book, and I believe that that page that you've just read from is the only place in the entire book where religion is mentioned. I just say that because I'm sometimes accused of dragging religion in everywhere. There's very, very little of that in the book. Now, dragging down, I think that the understanding of life, and indeed of science generally, the understanding of the universe generally, that we now have, the beginning of the 21st century, is an astoundingly rich, poetically valuable, truly wonderful achievement of our species, something that we have every right to be proud of. You could spend a lifetime imbibing and learning and understanding and increasing understanding of this view that we now have. It is incomparably richer than anything that our ancestors in past centuries could have. It is an enormous privilege to have it. No one individual could possibly comprehend it. It's a lifetime's worth just to understand bits of it. And I think it is demeaning to retreat from that to a medieval worldview which simply says, God done it, which is so trite, so cheap, so oversimple, so parochial, and so impotent in the face of the huge phenomena which need to be explained and which now are being explained.
Now, I think there are some scientists who are both religious and scientists and find the two compatible. And I'll give us an example, Francis Collins, who is the head of the Human Genome Project and feels that his investigation of the genetic code is basically a way also of investigating God's design, that the genetic code is an example of God's intricate design.
It's so superfluous, isn't it? I mean, here we have a beautiful explanation for how life comes about, starting from simple beginnings, and that makes God redundant. And then Francis Collins and others want to smuggle God back in and say, oh, well, natural selection was God's way of doing it. And what that's saying is that God the designer chose as his method of design a method which would look exactly as though he wasn't there. He chose a method which would make him himself redundant. He chose the method that made him superfluous. Why bother to postulate him at all in that case?
My guest is evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins, author of the bestseller The God Delusion. We'll hear more from Dawkins after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins. He's an atheist who finds science and a belief in God incompatible. His bestseller, The God Delusion, is now out in paperback. You feel a sense of awe from science and from trying to get to the bottom of what science has to tell us about the history of the world and every creature on it. Now, some people would argue that science can help explain how the species evolved, but it can't give meaning to existence, that only religion is the kind of the worldview, the lens that you can see life and the world through, that is inherently about giving meaning to life and existence. How would you answer that?
Well, I think the first thing I'd say is that the universe doesn't owe us meaning. There's no reason why there should be any meaning. It might be comforting if there is. It might be consoling. It would be nice to think that there's meaning in everything. But we are not owed meaning. If there isn't any meaning, there isn't any meaning, and that's just tough. However, you can make your own meaning in two different ways. One way is a personal one, and each one of us living our lives can give our lives meaning. Our lives may have meaning in terms of the work that we do, the art that we create, the music that we create, the science that we do, all our family life, our love for our spouse or our children, our love for nature, our love for some sport. There are all sorts of ways in which we can give our own lives meaning. That's the personal way, and that's the first way. The second way is that we can give meaning to life in a scientific sense, where we actually say the meaning of life is, and I've tried to do this in many of my books, such as The Selfish Gene, The Blind Watchmaker, the meaning of life is how we understand, how we interpret the existence of life. It's due to evolution, it's due to natural selection. Natural selection favors certain things and not other things. We develop a deep and satisfying understanding of the meaning of life in that scientific sense. Similarly, cosmologists may develop the meaning of their own subject. Geologists may develop a meaning of their own subject. These are very worthwhile, and they give life richness. But I return to my initial point. Even if you are not satisfied by those things, even if you feel there's got to be some more detailed meaning, there is absolutely no reason why there should be. The universe, as I said, does not owe us meaning.
As you point out in your book, religion is ubiquitous. So where do you think it comes from? As you point out in your book, everybody has their favorite theory about that. What's yours?
Yes, it is ubiquitous, at least anthropologically speaking. Every culture seems to have something equivalent to religion. Not every individual has, and that I think is important. So it's not ubiquitous in that sense. I think it's not that difficult to see why ideas which are appealing are ones that people hold. Ideas like life after death are very appealing, and it does seem to be a psychological weakness among humans to believe things that they would like to be true, even if there's no evidence for them. And quite often when I'm having discussions or arguments with people, they will say, oh, but I couldn't bear to believe that there's no God. I couldn't bear to, but life just wouldn't be worth living if there was no life after death or something like that. And as though that was a reason for believing it. And I think for them it really is a reason for believing in it. They can't see the difference between something for which you believe because there's evidence for it and something which you believe because it would be nice if it were true. Well, unfortunately, there are many things that would be nice but aren't true. But this does seem to be the case, that the human psychology does suffer from this weakness, and so that would be one approach to explaining it. I have various approaches to it. I'm one of those, and there are quite a lot of people now in biologists who believe that religion evolved not because it had a Darwinian advantage itself, but because it is a byproduct of psychological dispositions which had an advantage. And I suppose this psychological disposition, one example of that psychological disposition is the one I've just mentioned, which is the disposition to believe things because it would be nice if they were true. That's one of them. Another one that I particularly stressed in my book, is a disposition among children to believe whatever they're told by their parents or other elders in the tribal culture. So I think there is a genuinely good Darwinian advantage in children believing what they're told, because life is perilous and human children are very vulnerable. And by far the best way for a child to decide what's the best thing to do under many circumstances is to listen to your parents. So I'm suggesting that natural selection, Darwinian selection, built into child brains, the rule, believe whatever your parents tell you. And that's why children don't jump into fires and don't jump into the sea when they might get drowned and that kind of thing. You obey your parents. But if you have a built-in rule that says, believe your parents, believe whatever your parents tell you, that rule has no way of distinguishing good advice, like don't jump in the fire, from bad advice, like do a rain dance in order to make the rains come.
Richard Dawkins is the author of The God Delusion. He's a professor of the public understanding of science at Oxford University. Our interview was recorded last year. We'll hear more of it in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. From Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Richard Dawkins, author of the bestseller The God Delusion. Then we talk with Francis Collins, a renowned geneticist who gave up atheism to become an evangelical Christian. He's the author of The Language of God. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins. In his bestseller, The God Delusion, he writes about why he's an atheist and why he thinks science is incompatible with a belief in God. Dawkins is a professor of the public understanding of science at Oxford University. Now, in trying to investigate the probability that a God exists through the lens that you have, which is evolutionary biology, you say any creative intelligence of sufficient complexity to design anything comes into existence only at the end product of an extended process of gradual evolution. In other words, what you're saying there, if there was a being as intelligent as God, that God would have had to emerge at the end of evolution, not the very beginning of it. Would you explain your thinking on that a little bit more?
Yes, that's the fundamental consciousness-raising that I think Darwinian evolution gives us. If it were ever shown that life on this planet was designed, if somebody came up with unequivocal evidence, say that bacterial life was artificially designed on this planet, then I would say how tremendously exciting. Who was the designer? It must have been some extraterrestrial intelligence, perhaps following Francis Crick's slightly jokey suggestion of directed panspermia. He suggested that life might have been seeded on Earth in the nose cone of a rocket sent from a distant civilization that wanted to spread its form of life around the universe. The point I'm making is that if there is a designer of life, the very nature of the argument says that that designer has to be immensely complicated, immensely intelligent, immensely improbable statistically, and therefore cannot just have happened, cannot just suddenly spring into existence de novo. It must have evolved by the same slow, gradual process as we have seen in life on this Earth. So if life was created on this planet by deliberate design, then the designer must have evolved somewhere else in the universe as the end product of, or as a late product of, some kind of evolutionary process, probably a very different kind of evolutionary process, but some kind of incremental process that moves step by step from simplicity to complexity. Now, I don't really believe that's happened on this planet. I don't think Francis Crick did either. I believe that life did originate on this planet as a simple beginning by processes that we can, what we shall eventually understand, lying within the laws of chemistry, which kick-started the process of evolution by natural selection, which then went on its upward way by its slow, steady, incremental process, producing greater complexity, greater elegance, greater diversity, until it culminated in the mammals and birds and trees and things that we see today.
So in that sense, you find the idea of an intelligent God incompatible with the concept of evolution. No, go ahead.
Well, put it this way, at least it's incompatible with the kind of argument which creationists put forward. The favorite argument of creationists is, how could you possibly explain the chance existence of something like an eye or a brain? And of course you can't. You have to have a gradual, slow, incremental process to do it. And by the very same token, God would have to have the same kind of explanation. You can't use the argument on the one hand to say, well, eyes can't have evolved, and on the other hand, use the argument to say God, evade the argument, which will say God can't have just happened. What I want to say is that God indeed can't have just happened. If there are gods in the universe, they must be the end product of slow incremental processes. If there are beings in the universe that we would treat as gods if we met them, because they very likely may be so much more advanced than us, that we would worship them almost as gods, but they must have come about by an incremental process, gradually.
If you look at, like, the human sense of morality, can you ask the question, why haven't we evolved more morally as human beings? I mean, we still have wars, and there's still, like, violence and rape and decapitation and all of that.
Well, I mean, I think in a way the question's the other way around. If you look at the selfish gene view of life, the question rather is, why are we as moral as we are? And we are actually quite surprisingly moral compared to what you might naively expect on a Darwinian nature red in tooth and claw view. On a naive Darwinian view, we should behave morally towards our close relatives, our offspring, our grandchildren, our cousins and brothers and things, but not towards just anybody. Similarly, we should behave morally towards other individuals whom we recognize as likely to encounter us again and again through life, who therefore may be in a position to reciprocate, to pay back the favor. Now, there are good Darwinian accounts of both those kinds of altruism, which I suppose is a kind of proto-morality. But we are faced with a problem of why we are as moral as we are towards non-relatives and towards perfect strangers, indeed members of other species, whom we're never going to meet again and who have no opportunity to reciprocate. And that, I think, is a kind of mistaken byproduct, a mistake which I thoroughly approve of, by the way. It's a blessed mistake. But I think that we are programmed by our Darwinian past from a time when our ancestors lived in small groups, when every member of the group in which you lived would have been a clan member, would have been a cousin of some sort or closer, and every member of every person that you meet would be a clan member who you'd meet again and again and who might therefore reciprocate. And so the rule of thumb was built into our ancestral brains: be nice to everyone you meet, behave morally towards everyone you meet. Now that rule of thumb goes on being played out now, even though we no longer live in these small bands.
Would you argue that although religion has been responsible for a lot of war and persecution, that at the same time religion has been responsible for a lot of good, for a lot of generous and charitable instincts that have protected people around the world?
Well, yes, it probably is true as a matter of fact that there have been plenty of good people who are religious. Of course, we all know them. I mean, some of the nicest people I've ever met have been religious, and it shines through. So that I don't think is in dispute. What I think's more interesting is to ask, is there any general reason why religious faith should predispose you to be good or bad? If there's a general reason why it might predispose you to be good, I suppose it might take the form, God wants me to be good. I'm fulfilling God's will. Or if I'm bad, God will punish me, something like that. And I'm sure there are people who are motivated by that sort of consideration. I don't think it's a terribly noble reason to be good. It sort of smacks a little bit of being good only because you're being watched, because there's a great surveillance camera in the sky watching your every move and listening to your every thought. I think that somebody who's good, in spite of not believing that he's watched at all, just simply good for good's sake, that does seem to me to be a rather more noble reason to be good.
Richard Dawkins, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Richard Dawkins recorded last year. His book, The God Delusion, recently came out in paperback. This month, he's giving lectures in several cities around the U.S. Coming up, Francis Collins, a geneticist and former atheist turned evangelical Christian. He finds his belief in God perfectly compatible with his scientific research. This is Fresh Air. When trying to comprehend the universe and our place in it, do you turn to science, religion, or both? We just heard from Richard Dawkins, an atheist who finds science incompatible with a belief in God. Francis Collins, a renowned geneticist, gave up atheism to become an evangelical Christian. Collins headed the Human Genome Project, which in the year 2000 completed the mapping of the human genome, the hereditary code of life which includes all the DNA of our species. He's currently the director of the National Human Genome Research Institute at the National Institutes of Health. Earlier in his career, Collins and his team of researchers identified the genes for Huntington's disease, cystic fibrosis, and a form of adult leukemia. In his book, The Language of God, Collins explains why he believes in God and why his scientific research deepens his faith rather than challenges it. When you look at genetic material and when you were mapping the human genome, how did you see the intricacy of the genetic material that you were analyzing as being related to your belief in God?
Well, whether you're a believer or not, looking at the intricacy, the complexity of the human genome, our own DNA instruction book, has to give you a sense of awe. as you page through letters A, C, T, and G, 3 billion of them, recognizing that this is the instruction book that's capable somehow of carrying out all of the steps that have to happen for a human being from a single-celled embryo to a very complex organism, you can't help but marvel. For someone who's a believer, as 40% of scientists are, it has an added feature, and that is that you're glimpsing God's creative genius. And in the process of uncovering this instruction book, maybe you're getting just a hint of what God's mind is all about, which is a pretty amazing thing to contemplate.
When you say that the human genome is our instruction manual, what do you mean?
I think it's a pretty good metaphor. DNA is this information molecule. It's a particularly simple one in a certain way in that it only has 4 letters in its alphabet. There are actually 4 chemical bases, but it's the order of those letters, A, C, G, and T, that carries out all the instructions that we as human beings and every other organism too have to do. And it can be written out in a linear fashion. If you printed it out on regular font size and regular thickness of paper and piled the pages on top of each other, it would be as high as the Washington Monument. And you have all that information inside each cell of your body. So it's a very large book, but you can think of it as a book, and I think you're probably on the right track. And a misspelling somewhere in that book could cause you to fall ill with some problem. And your book and somebody else's book are not going to be identical, but they're going to be 99.9% the same, because that's how similar we humans are to each other. And I guess you could say we're still beginning readers. We're trying to figure out how to make sense of these 3.1 billion letters in our book in order to begin to apply it more effectively for medical purposes.
You say in your book that a literal reading of Genesis would lead to the complete collapse of the science of physics, chemistry, cosmology, geology, and biology. What do you mean?
Well, if you look at the evidence that comes to us from things like the rate at which galaxies are receding, or the radioactive dating of rocks, or the study of DNA and the relatedness of living beings, there is no way you can backtrack the origins of all this to a period 6,000 years ago, which is what an absolute literal reading of Genesis would require. You just can't tweak around the edges of the consequences of those scientific investigations to get to 6,000 years instead of 13.7 billion. You just can't do it. When it comes to the evangelical Christians, obviously Genesis 1 and 2 is a serious issue for them. I would just point out that the story of creation in the first 2 chapters of the Bible is actually 2 different stories. If you look at what's in Genesis 1 and then what's in Genesis 2, there are 2 descriptions of how humans came to be. And they're not entirely consistent with each other, which might be a tip-off that one should not assume that every single word there is intended to be a literal historic description.
And Richard Dawkins made the case that science and God are not very compatible, because science is something that is based on empirical evidence. Science is based on evidence, and religion is based on faith. And for most people, faith in a supernatural being. So how do you reconcile the empiricism, the evidence that science requires, with the faith and sometimes supernatural belief of religion?
Well, Scripture in Hebrews says faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Evidence, interesting, right there in the definition. I think this is a common misconception, that faith is something you arrive at purely by emotion and not something where, in fact, one can assemble evidences that point in the direction of God's existence and make that more plausible than the denial of his existence. At least that's what I learned in my 20s.
What evidence would you put in that category?
I would certainly point to this knowledge of right and wrong that we humans uniquely have, which asks us to behave in certain ways that sometimes are an absolute scandal to evolution, because evolution only cares about propagating your DNA. What's that all about? That seems like a signpost. And of course, the evidence is about the amazing fine-tuning of the universe, which seems to have been put there for some purpose so that we could exist as beings of complex chemistry Those seem to be crying out for an explanation. They're not proofs, don't get me wrong. But a scientist who says, well, science is sufficient to disprove God because we haven't caught him in our microscopes or our other means of measurements, is committing a logical fallacy. If God has any meaning, God is outside of nature, at least in part. Science is only really valid in investigating nature. So science is essentially forced to remain silent on the subject of whether God exists or not. And that is sometimes forgotten, I think, by the very strong atheistic viewpoints put forward by some scientists, particularly those working in the field of evolution.
Has mapping the human genome bolstered your view that of evolution?
Absolutely. And this is one of the reasons I wrote this book called The Language of God, was to try to put forward what for me is a very comfortable and happy synthesis of being both a believer in God and also one who studies DNA and sees within it the absolutely incontrovertible evidence that Darwin's theory of evolution was correct in terms of the common descent of all living things from a common ancestor. There's been much disagreement, of course, about this, and great anxieties have been expended on the question of whether this is a correct theory, and particularly whether it can be compatible with interpretations of the Bible. From my perspective, God gave us the ability to look at the details of his creation. He gave us the ability with intelligence and with the instruments that the human mind has managed to put together to read out not only the letters of our own DNA book, but also that of many other organisms, including our closest relatives, the chimpanzee. When you look at that information and you see the precise similarities between our own DNA and that of other species, and particularly when you look at the details, not just the general similarity, which might after all be considered as use of common themes in multiple acts of special creation, you can't help but come to the conclusion that there is in fact a common ancestor of all living organisms on this planet, including ourselves. I have no trouble with that. As a believer who also looks to the Bible for answers to important questions, I don't think Genesis 1 was intended as a scientific textbook. I think it was intended to teach us something about who God is and who we are in relationship to him. And just as St. Augustine in 400 AD, studying Genesis 1 and 2, was left puzzled about exactly what was being described there, I think we all, if we're honest, have to be a bit puzzled too. And therefore, when you put together what we see in that description of creation with what God has given us the chance to learn through science, there's really no conflict. It was all his plan. He just carried it out using the tools of evolution.
Is that what you mean when you use the term theistic evolution to describe your belief?
Most scientists who are biologists who are also believers have come to this same kind of synthesis, often without knowing what name to put on it. I arrived at this same kind of conclusion after becoming a believer in my 20s and trying to figure out how that fit together with the science I was learning of genetics. It all suddenly made sense. Well, sure, if God had the intention of creating life, this wonderful diversity of life that we see all around us on this planet, and ourselves, special creatures with whom he could have fellowship, in whom he would imbue the soul and the knowledge of good and evil and the ability to practice free will. Who are we to say that evolution was a way we wouldn't have chosen? It's an incredibly elegant way to achieve this.
Francis Collins, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a real pleasure talking with you, Terry.
Francis Collins headed the Human Genome Project, which mapped the DNA of our species. His book is called The Language of God: A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief. Our interview was recorded last year. Earlier in the show, we heard from scientist and atheist Richard Dawkins. You can download a podcast featuring both of these interviews on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Paranoid Park. David Edelstein reviews the new film from director Gus Van Sant. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Paranoid Park is a new film directed by Gus Van Sant, based on a young adult novel by Blake Nelson. At the Cannes Film Festival last May, the jury awarded Van Sant with a special prize for the film. Paranoid Park is set in the world of teenage skateboarders in Portland, Oregon. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Gus Van Sant embodies the notion of the director as conceptual artist. He regards everything he does as some kind of experiment. His first film, Mala Noche, was a tale of romantic obsession that played like an expressionist fever dream. Then came Drugstore Cowboy, outrageous in its premise, the addict as Western outlaw, but conventional in technique. Then My Own Private Idaho, conventional in its theme of teen alienation, but outrageous in technique, a mix of Shakespeare, surrealism, and urban grit. When Van Sant made formula studio pictures like Good Will Hunting, he told interviewers he was working in the tradition of Renaissance artists who strive to suppress their personal voices. I'm not kidding. A remake of Hitchcock's Psycho posed the question, if you replicate a film shot by shot, what will you wind up with? It turns out, nothing pretty. Paranoid Park belongs in the series that began with Van Sant's Jerry and continued with Elephant and The Last Days, trance-like works in which you drifted through time and space with non-actors, or actors behaving like non-actors. This is the best of those freeform works, a supernaturally perfect fusion of his art project head trip aesthetic and Blake Nelson's finely tuned first-person young adult novel. The protagonist and narrator, Alex, played by Gabe Nevins, is a Portland, Oregon teen whose father has moved out and who gravitates toward a grotty skate park for what he calls, in voiceover, thrown-away kids. One day, Alex gets called to the school office, where a detective, played by Dan Liu, asks about a grisly death near Paranoid Park.
Let me tell you what my situation is. I have the security guard, and we find him deceased on the railroad tracks. And so we're thinking maybe he tripped or he fell. But the autopsy says he was struck by an object. And we also have a witness that says he saw somebody throw something over the bridge into the river. We happen to have that object, and it's a skateboard. Now, the funny thing is there's some DNA evidence on the skateboard that puts it at the scene of the crime. Where did you go?
I drove around downtown a little to Subway and got something to eat.
Okay, there's about 1,002 Subways. Which one did
you go to? By the waterfront.
Okay, and the one over in the World Trade Center, that one?
Yes.
Okay, what'd you get?
Turkey and ham on Italian herb and cheese bread, toasted tomato, lettuce, pickle, olive, mustard, oil, and vinegar.
Did you get mayo?
No.
Gotta have mayo with that.
Mayo's sick.
Mayo's sick. What kind of bread was it?
Italian herb and cheese.
Okay, you have a receipt in your pocket for that?
No, I don't keep Subway receipts.
Okay, how much did it cost then?
Like six something. Subway's expensive.
6 inch, 12 inch?
Six.
6 inch for $6, so you must have got the meal then, right?
No, I just got a drink.
Okay.
Large, right. Dr. Pepper.
Who'd you eat with?
Myself.
Based on his sandwich description, I'd believe Alex, but it turns out via flashback that he was at the scene of the death, although guilt or innocence are inadequate to describe what he did. Although he longs to tell someone, his father, who seems oblivious to his needs, or even that detective, he pulls into himself. Nelson's book is linear, and even invokes Dostoevsky, since Alex is reading Notes from Underground. Van Sant dumps Dostoevsky and ruptures the narrative line to drive home Alex's inability to get at his own mixed-up feelings. The director and cinematographer Christopher Doyle leap from the static and realistic to the dreamlike and woozy with Super 8 skateboard footage that seems to bubble up from the collective unconscious of the misfits of Paranoid Park. The soundtrack is a vivid mashup, Beethoven, country, the melancholy Elliott Smith, capped with Nino Rota's carnivalesque Fellini music, which drowns out Alex's cheerleader girlfriend. Van Sant found his leading actor from a casting notice on MySpace, and Nevins has a good soft face, a 7-year-old's head on a 17-year-old's body. There are times when his inexpressiveness is a little too inexpressive, but the voiceover narration keeps the movie grounded, and Alex's tumultuous emotions are right there in the film's look and sound. In life, when you look at a teenage boy with no expression, his clothes drooping, his long hair in his eyes, perhaps toting a skateboard, you might construe his blank affect as a sign of the blankness within. But in Van Sant's hands, that supposed void turns out to be not too empty, but too full. Paranoid Park is a trip into space, not outer, but inner, in ways that movies rarely are. This time, the experiment is a raging success.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Paranoid Park opens today in New York and L.A. and can also be seen in the pay-per-view section of many cable systems as part of the series called IFC in Theaters. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to educate taxpayers and protect the environment through its mining campaign. Information at pewtrusts.org. From the Vital Projects Fund, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, now exhibiting etchings by Lucian Freud. Details at moma.org. And from the NASDAQ Educational Foundation, dedicated to innovation and entrepreneurship around the world. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a former fighter in the militant Palestinian group Fatah and a former fighter in an elite Israeli commando unit talk about co-founding Combatants for Peace. And Lauren Mazel talks about conducting the New York Philharmonic in North Korea. Join us for the next Fresh Air.